Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to gay or bisexual men. If you have any questions you would like to make during this broadcast, please feel free to send them to me at bonkay@aol.com, that's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E, @aol.com. We're getting ready for the holiday season, which is always a difficult time for our women, the time from Thanksgiving on till the end of, middle of February till Valentine's Day, with so many family reminders and so many memories that we have as we go through this. And that's why I'm very excited to bring on my special guest tonight, Mary Ann Glynn, who has not been with us for a while. So I'm thrilled to have her back again because Mary Ann is someone who specializes in post-traumatic stress disorder. And welcome back, Mary Ann. Hello? Can you hear me? Let me see here if I lost Mary Ann. Hold on one moment. Hello? Hello? For some reason, I'm not getting through with Mary Ann in here. So, Mary Ann, maybe you could call. Do you hear me now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay, good. Now I hear you.
Okay, good. All right.
Yes. So how are you?
I am still very good, thank you. Glad to be
good.
Here.
I appreciate your coming with us today because it's been a couple of years
And
so much more research has been done since you were last here about post-traumatic stress disorder and how it affects relationships.
Yeah.
And I think you were really on the verge of all those discoveries on your own. You're one of the leaders in that kind of you know, field of understanding how this affects women. So one of the things that I'd like for you, if you could start off by explaining to people, what does post-traumatic stress disorder mean? Because I think that so many of us are used to that terminology when it came to soldiers coming home from war without understanding how it is now. Right. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. That what was used to be called, I think it was World War II, maybe it was World War I, shell shock, was the first time that it was noticed that there was such a thing as post-traumatic stress. And initially it became associated with people fighting in wars. You know, you'd fight in wars. It's very traumatizing. People are dying around you. Your life is threatened every minute. And they would see people come home and drink or be violent or be non-functional. And they started to put together that there was such this syndrome. And then they started to notice that it could happen with all kinds of traumatic events, like, for instance, a natural disaster, something like a 9/11 or a flood where you lose your home or people die, a car accident, sexual molestation or rape, physical assault, medical trauma, meaning like, you know, sometimes people have surgeries that can be traumatic, or a child can have to go through surgery and that could be traumatic. You know, the loss of someone, catastrophic illness or injury, things that cause either tremendous loss or threat or death, or sometimes it can be not just to ourselves, but watching it happen to someone else, okay? But the thing that causes, one of the biggest features of the cause of traumatic stress is that a person feels helpless in the face of the threat. In other words, like, for instance, if someone were going to rape you, and let's say you knew martial arts and you screamed and you fought them off, you wouldn't feel helpless. You would feel like you, even though you were assaulted, you wouldn't possibly not feel a lot of post-traumatic stress. Now, if you were helpless and you just went into a state of shock or freeze like most people would do, and you couldn't get away, you couldn't fight, you couldn't run, that would cause severe post-traumatic stress. It's being helpless in the face of the threat, or helpless in the face of helping someone else who is, say, getting run over a car or something like that. So so that's the typical idea of post-traumatic stress. You know, some like major event that is very traumatic and causes a big change in your life or a change in how you see yourself. And that is what is still, to this day, how it's defined in psychology, unfortunately, because there are other kinds of trauma that we know of, and clinicians do use it and understand it, but it's not kind of verified in the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychology. The only one that's really kind of acknowledged is the one where, you know, you go to a war and you come back, and then you start to have nightmares, you start to have flashbacks, you have dissociative reactions and avoidance behaviors and those kinds of things, which I won't go into. But we now know of these other kinds of trauma that are more ongoing, which is the kind of thing that your people who are listening would be familiar with. So psychological abuse that is ongoing, right? Now that can be something like bullying or verbal abuse, or being as a child neglected, for instance, or an unpredictable parent with a bad temper, or parents fighting in front of you, and those types of things that happen ongoing in childhood, we call that developmental trauma, although it still isn't recognized as a diagnosis. And then there's something which, you know, describes relationship trauma or workplace bullying or that kind of thing that's psychological. And that would be, they're calling that complex post-traumatic stress, but it's more like psychological traumatic stress. And that's probably what most of the people here have gone through. And if you want to, I can describe some of, you know, what that means exactly. This kind of ongoing
trauma that
can cause the same kinds of symptoms in the end. Okay, or ongoing. Okay, so When we're talking about domestic abuse, most, you know, people associate that with physical abuse, assault, different things like that. But most of the time, it's psychological. Okay? Uh-huh. And it could be an it could be more obvious, like someone screaming at you, losing their temper, or it can be very subtle. And that's the hardest kind that to identify, and it's the hardest kind to even know you're in for a long, long time. And it can be simply in a form of control, okay? Control is abuse. Abuse is control. They're basically the same thing. So the types of more subtle abuse would be, for instance, manipulation of perception or gaslighting, right? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with gaslighting, what that is?
Yes. In our community, we call it gaylighting because it's the same thing.
Gaylighting.
People
okay.
making you think you're crazy. Men thinking, you know, that you're crazy because you're accusing them of being gay because
right.
you see everything right in front of you, and they're trying to make you think that there's something wrong in your imagination.
Right, that you don't,
yeah.
you don't see what you see and you don't hear what you hear or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or try to, or maybe you sometimes might get an aggressive or hostile response, so you stop asking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. So for gaslighting, the person has a need to mold you to their perception so that they can feel comfortable. Or they can hide something, or both, okay? And if someone, and you probably all experience this, if someone is continually, on a continual basis, confidently telling you that your perception is wrong, you can start to think that your perception is wrong, right? You start to doubt yourself, and it can really
mm-hmm.
do a number on your sense of reality and make you feel like you're crazy, right? And a second type of subtle abuse is control, such as financial, you know, control of finances. It's not
mm-hmm.
the same thing as two people agreeing that one partner is going to handle the bills and stuff like that. It means that one person is going to control the finances and they insist on it without the other person's input or consent. Sometimes they keep it hidden even, or they keep the other person from having money. Social control would be either directly or indirectly curtailing or limiting someone's social circle, contact with their family and friends, causing isolation, sometimes not wanting the partner to work or attend school or church or synagogue or whatever. And all the abuse that I'm describing, even if it includes physical, psychological control, deceit. That's not usually included in psychological abuse, but I think it's probably the worst form of psychological abuse, deceit, because, you know, the amount of gaslighting and just the betrayal of it all, you know, the traumatic effect that has on your life when you find out that someone's been lying to you or they're not who they say they are. It's just completely devastating. So
I know this takes a little bit of a turn in the conversation, but I just want to ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
When women are suffering from people who are doing this to them, you know, creating
mm-hmm.
post-traumatic stress disorder,
mm-hmm.
Do you feel these are primarily, like, in a relationship with women and men who have personality disorders that are, you know, the ones who are creating the situation, either narcissistic
well,
or sociopathic? Personality
yes.
disorders.
Yes, because, if someone is gay and they're trying to hide that, that's going to look like a personality disorder, you know, because there's a lying and deception going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a need to not be questioned and, you know, they're not fully there, you know, they're not fully engaged,
mm-hmm.
they're not fully able to bond and be
mm-hmm.
probably empathetic and let their guard down, you know, I'm imagining all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in a heterosexual relationship, I would say that, yes, it would be a personality disorder. Most of the time that does this. I mean, people, you know, there's a kind of control where it's the more typical thing maybe you've heard of in the past, you know, that real cycle of abuse where a person loses their temper, for instance, right, and on the partner, but then feels bad about it. And then goes back and tries to make up, Right. But then they, since they don't really have insight into why they're doing it, they're bound to repeat it. And I wouldn't call that person having a personality disorder. They might have bipolar disorder. They might have some abandonment issues. You know, there might be some things like that going on because they might have the ability to look at themselves sometimes or feel remorse. But most of the time with it, what you're talking about, people with personality disorders, they never seem to feel remorse. They never take responsibility. They don't. They don't feel.
I'm for sure they don't.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So that's a living, really, that's a much worse situation.
Yeah, and most of our husbands, even though they were gay, that was probably like not the, that was not the downside of it. You know, that was a bad part of it. But I don't know, like I say, I'm never quite sure whether it's what came first, the chicken or the egg, that you have, you know, many of them are narcissistic. It's all about them all of the time. They're able to compartmentalize their lives, but they're also able to really mistreat their wives emotionally. I mean, some physically, but mostly emotionally. You know, when you tell the person that you love that she's never good enough for you and you don't want to touch her, that, you know, she gives you the creeps, she smells, she has body odor, so he can't make love to you. I mean, they strip you away slowly, one step at a time. It's not something that happens the first day.
Right.
It's
a very gradual,
getting more frustrating and frustrated in the relationship, you know, they just become more abusive in the relationship mentally. And
well, that sounds
a
like
lot of our women, you know, in all fairness, a lot of our women came out of abusive homes to start with.
Yeah,
you know, where there was
yeah.
all kinds of dysfunction in the homes and, you know, it could be drug addiction, mental illness, you know, lack of parenting skills. So a lot of women didn't grow up with self-confidence to even know how to go about, you know, fighting this.
Right. And the other thing about that is that if you grow up in a, you know, if you have previous childhood abuse, trauma, whatever, or even neglect, or even a parent who's critical or doesn't listen to you, and, you know, all of those things where you don't develop a good sense of self, and or you're in an environment in which you have to kind of survive the environment, it's not particularly safe or it's unpredictable, or someone's drinking or those kinds of things, then if you get into a relationship later on where there is a similar type of abuse, you go into automatic. You know, you know how to deal with that. You all, your response to that is already to probably freeze or dissociate, you know, because you had to do that as a child. So you all, you know, it's like you're more likely to get controlled and more easily gaslit and all that stuff because you know how to kind of freeze up so you can survive that uncomfortable situation. So it could be harder on somebody like that because it kind of brings up the initial trauma and then you go into your trauma response. There was something that you said, though, before about, guys who are gay that can get married, right? The fact that they're getting married at all, well, what does that say about their personality? You know, like they cannot. That's similar to a narcissistic personality, for instance, because they probably have so much shame or humiliation or something that makes them dissociate from their own trauma. Okay, I'm guessing. Tell me if I'm wrong. So they have to defend that and protect that. And so they'll do whatever they have to do to keep that down, to keep it from coming up. You know, they have to, you know, this other persona that they're trying to hold on to. And so that always involves hurting the person you're with, right?
Exactly.
That person, just
exactly.
by being in a, just by being in an intimate relationship with you, demands a certain amount of intimacy, right? It demands emotional intimacy, never mind sexual intimacy. It demands honesty. It demands loving and caring responses. And if you're not even yourself, if you're shut down to yourself, and you know, you can't honestly be engaged in that relationship, you're going to feel threatened, right? All the time. It's
exactly.
Gonna be, you know, you're going to have to blame the other person, you're going to have to hate them, anything but look at yourself, honestly, I suppose.
I think you really pinpointed that right on the head. And I don't think these guys necessarily, you know, meant to deceive us when they married us. You know, I know a lot of women disagree with me. I think they were trying to fool themselves, not just fool us, that they were convinced that if they could be a good husband, they could be straight. Because no matter how much more homosexuality is accepted in this country today, it's still a minority. It's still shunned upon in many parts of the country. People still get beat up. People still are made fun of. And so if you don't have to be gay and you have a chance of being straight, why wouldn't you want to be straight? And I think that these guys are just, it's so confusing. As I say, I think if everybody was born and they had, who was gay, had a G tattooed on their foot when they were born, they would know what their sexuality would be. But it is confusing because some people, once again, when they're in their teens or early 20s, they emotionally really fall for someone, you know, and they think this is love, and in their world it is love. And they're really thinking because they can perform sex, maybe it's not, you know, exciting like it would be otherwise, but at least they can perform it. They really are hoping not to be gay. And, you know, it works
they can
for
be
a while.
Normal, right?
Yeah, and it works for a while, but after a while it stops working because physically, as you mature and get older, it's very hard for a man who is gay to continue to have sex, and then he starts having these feelings for other men. And then he starts resenting his wife because he feels, and I will use this word, and I put it in quotations, my ex-husband used to use it with me all the time, trapped. They feel that you're trapping them, even though they've married you in good faith, and you have no idea what the problem is because they can't be honest with you. And if you do ask them, they start denying it and telling you you're crazy. That's where the gaslighting comes in, where I call it the gay lighting. But, you know, they'll tell you that you're imagining things, you don't know what you're seeing, you don't know what you're reading, and that you're making this up, and your mind's fooling you, and there must be something wrong with you. You know, they make you very defensive, right?
Bonnie, do you think it's gotten any, just, if you don't mind me asking a question, do you think it's gotten any less that gay men are marrying women as it's becoming more accepted in the country?
I think so. I think it's becoming less. But, you know, the things that we don't factor into it are religion, cultures.
Yeah.
So if you're from certain cultures, it doesn't matter if you're gay or not. You have to get married.
That's true.
That accounts for a lot of different, you know, for instance, from India, from the Middle East, from the Arabic countries. Where homosexuality is just not allowable or acceptable.
Yeah.
So it's a matter that, you know, people have to get married and then they torture their wives. I just had, you know, last year we had our new book come out, Straight Wives, Shattered Lives, Volume 3. And this is a very compelling story in there why one of my wonderful members who's from, you know, Pakistan and, the torture that she went through with her husband, who from the beginning of that marriage, I mean, he had sex with her maybe twice or three times just to have children, but he wouldn't touch her after that or let her come near him and, you know, constantly rejecting her, making her feel inadequate. You know, she never had, when you read her story, you know, I just felt like crying over and over again. She's a wonderful woman. And even when her husband, finally she had the strength to leave him. And her whole community, you know, blamed her. And when he died, they held her responsible. She had nothing to do with it. Natural causes, you know. But they said, see, because you left him and
you
broke his heart. And, and the whole community, like, turned on her because that's what their culture is. And I have so many, I have a lot of men who come to me, gay men, who I counsel all the time about their coming out issues. And, you know, I really work with them, and some of them, it's so sad because if they come out, they're going to destroy their families' lives, not just them.
Right.
And so it is very sad.
And their,
so it
their
does,
kids,
I think
and their kids think they're hetero, and so what's that going to do to their kids when they find out they're not who they, their father is and who they thought he was?
Exactly. You know, I have so many different implications here, and, you know, I feel so bad for everybody involved in the situation, but I still say the men had a choice and the women didn't.
That's
the men
true.
Had a choice, at least, and I tell them now, you may not have had a choice in your homosexuality, but you do have the choice to be honest. And you owe it to your
wife
to be honest. But for those men who are lacking conscience, but those men who lack conscience, this is what they say to me. These are gay men who went into a marriage and who don't belong there to start with, who are making their wives miserable, and they'll say to me, the marriage wouldn't work anyway because we're too different. Yeah,
no.
You're too different. You're gay.
Right.
And she's
never
great.
Mind, you're gay.
That's the difference. You know, they don't want to take the responsibility. That's the problem. You know, they just want to,
how,
you know.
Do you see, I mean, do you see that mostly, or do you, I mean, you say you can't
yeah,
talk
I get a
to
lot
some
of
gay men. But is it mostly, do you feel like mostly the guys who marry women are very much not in touch with themselves? They're the ones who kind of are abusive because they're dishonest with themselves. They can't admit that there's something wrong
yeah,
with them.
Yeah, you know, they come
blame.
To me when they're ready to leave and they want advice. That's when
mm-hmm.
I hear from them. Because they met a guy,
mm-hmm.
now they're in love. I would call it in love, I'll call it in lust, because they finally met, you know, the man of their dreams for the moment.
Right.
And I understand it. You know, you're a gay man. You don't belong married to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you just have to be honest and tell the truth. I mean, why do you let your wife suffer day in and day out?
Right.
Thinking
why
that she's responsible for nothing she had nothing to do with.
Right. And it's because they are dishonest with themselves, that they can't look at themselves and say, well, I'm the one who's causing the problems in this marriage. I shouldn't be here. They're just not ready to deal with it. And so up until that point, they have to blame the wife, right?
Oh, even after that point. After they know that they have a boyfriend, they have a partner, they're still blaming the wife, that our marriage would have been more successful, if she would have been more supportive. I could have lived like that. You know, they just can't come to terms with being honest about it.
Are they blaming the wife for them being attracted to a gay man at this point? Is that the wife's fault?
My ex-husband did that. My ex-husband did.
So even at the very end, they can't say, like, well, the reason that this didn't work out is because I'm gay, or not even at the
yeah,
end.
Yeah, there's a lot of men like that and not admitting to
well,
it.
Well, that is
you
a personality. That does sound like a personality disorder, then.
I'm telling you,
that's
these guys have personality
yeah.
disorders.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of them are really dangerous. Some are really sociopaths. They create harm
yeah.
and danger along the way.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying that's because they're gay, you know, so I just want to be really
no.
clear. They
yes,
would be like that if they were
exactly
straight.
What you're saying. Yep, I got it.
So this is
got it.
One more thing added to the fire.
And they may go on with whatever gay partner they end up with, if they end up with someone in a relationship. They could do it with them, too. I mean, because usually a person like that, that's their personality. That's the way they are. That doesn't change.
Well, it's so funny because I'm in touch with a gentleman who used to be involved with my ex-husband. It was my ex-husband's first real love in life many years ago. And he was a really, loved this guy. He was, you know, younger than us. But he was wonderful to my children. They loved him. And they didn't mind going to my ex's house because he would be there. His name was Billy. And, you know, he would take really good care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And as their relationship went on, of course, he was wonderful to him in the beginning, just like he was to me. But then
mm-hmm.
after he got a little more secure in the relationship, it started becoming my relationship. And I remember Billy used to call me. Now, even now today, you know, we've gotten in touch again in the last year. And we talk and we laugh about it, how he was treated the same exact way. So it wasn't a gay thing. It's a personality disorder thing.
Right, and there's no ability for real intimacy with somebody like that because they're shut down from themselves. They're not even really connected to themselves. They're, you know, they probably have trauma. They have trauma, which is shut down and locked up a long time ago, and they have learned how to have a personality based on power and control and feeling comfortable. And that's what they, you know, that's what they probably learned early on somewhere along the line. And it's a dissociative thing, meaning, like I said, they're shut down. They're dissociated from their true pain. The pain is, like, deep down under there. So they go through their whole life maintaining that. They have to maintain that. And so if you're that way, there's no way you can have an intimate connection with anyone because
exactly.
that would involve,
they're not capable
that
of
would
it.
Involve feelings. That would involve feeling difficult feelings. It would involve empathy. And you, if you're shut down, you can't do that.
Exactly.
So,
now give us some good advice. Give me some good advice now for our women. Give us all. You're in a relationship. You're ending every. First of all, I always say If you're living in an abusive relationship, there's no way you can even think about healing until you get out of it. Would you agree with that?
Not entirely.
Okay.
I think if you're in it, you can start doing some things that can help you stop being so, like when you're in a situation like that, you can be dissociative, meaning like in order to survive, you kind of space out, you freeze, you shut down yourself, right? You shut down to your own emotions because your body is so uncomfortable. Your body might be going into, even though you might not be aware of it, if you're in an environment where it's kind of unpredictable or you're getting negative responses or a person snapping at you or you can't just be yourself without someone having an issue with it, you start to kind of go into kind of a hyper-vigilant state, you know. You start to, your body gets aroused from these kinds of negative responses and unpredictability. And so you kind of stay out of your body. The way to survive something like that is to kind of dissociate, to be out of kind of disconnected from your body. And you might not even realize you're doing that. But your body is doing it. You know, your body is going into this state where it's aroused, your heart rate is speeding up. You might have tightening of the muscles. Your senses might be over alert. You might be oversensitive. It's like a cortisol dump could be happening. And these could be small, little, subtle things. Like you ask your partner, "Oh, where were you? I was trying to call you. I couldn't get in touch with you all day." And you get some response you don't expect. Like, why don't you trust me? Why do you have to question me every minute? Right?
Uh-huh.
And so the body and you kind of go into this like, oh, state, and that's a survival response, even though it's subtle, but it does have an effect on the body. And over time, I wonder if a lot of your women can relate to this. Over time, it starts wearing down you psychologically and physically, like your ability to relax, sleep, can cause addictions and illnesses, lots of illnesses like autoimmune, chronic fatigue, pain, tension, headaches, back and neck pain, endocrine malfunction, environmental sensitivities, fibromyalgia, heart problems, even cancer has been related to ongoing stress like that. So what you want to do, you know, even if you're still in the relationship, is to notice, start making a mindful connection to yourself and start tracking what's going on in your body. Because when we're in a very uncomfortable situation, we tend to kind of exit the body. We don't know we're doing this, but we kind of stay in our head. It's kind of like we can become very disconnected from the body because we're having these tense or aroused reactions a lot. So what you want to do is to start practicing things like mindfulness. Okay, mindfulness is just learning how to be aware of what's going on in your thoughts, your emotion, and your body. You know, start doing some inner tracking. Start to come back into your body and find a sense of safety or self-soothing. And you can do that by things like meditation or yoga or walking or exercise or something, or just kind of sitting for a while and getting in touch with what you're feeling and thinking. And what your body feels, and to become aware of how you can feel a sense of safety or peace, whether it's looking at a beautiful photograph or looking out at nature or wrapping yourself in a blanket and just getting in touch with how that is soothing to your body and mind and noticing the sensations that causes. You know, how that can kind of change you from feeling maybe anxious to feeling a little bit more calm, soothed. It sounds like a small thing, but if you practice that kind of thing daily, you see it makes a big difference in kind of helping you regain your sense of self and your strength. And it gives you a more objective way of seeing your situation so that you can become more detached. You know what I mean by detached? Like you'll react
yeah,
less.
Yeah, I do.
You'll
mm-hmm.
kind of like observe more and react less and be less affected. And so you end up helping your body and mind, right? And it also can help you get clarity. But detachment is the most important thing. You know, detachment, because, you know, up until if you're not working on detachment and, you know, mindfulness being in your body, then your body's just reacting, you know, haywire.
And it's true. I told him you cannot be physically free until you're emotionally free. You have to
mm-hmm.
first be emotionally free of a bad relationship before you can just walk away and be okay. So
exactly.
I think that detachment is really important also when
yes.
thinking of what state of mind you need to be in, that you have to detach yourself from the situation, which always
mm-hmm.
isn't easy, as we know, right?
Right, because let's say you decide you want to become more mindful of what's going on and more detached. Well, the way to become more detached is to become more aware. Self-awareness, mindfulness. As you become aware of what's going on inside of you, that will make you more detached because you're, instead of just reacting, now you're kind of watching yourself react, or you're becoming aware of more of what's going on inside of you and what's making you react. And little by little, you become less, at some point, you might not react in the same way. It takes time. It takes practice. You also, if you become self-aware and start tracking inside of what's going on, you might see what those trigger points are, you know, what those buttons are. Like, let's say you get a bad reaction and you feel tense, and you notice that because you're tracking it, you feel a sense of shame, or like you're not good enough, or that you feel a tension in your chest, or that you have a knot in your stomach or something. And then that might even remind you, like, oh wow, I felt kind of like this back when my dad was drinking and yelling all the time. You know what I mean? Like, so it can give
uh-huh.
you awareness of even where your reactions are coming from. And all of those things help you to heal, to help you to detach from being, you know, getting your buttons pushed and getting baited into your body reacting in ways that you have before that are not conducive, that are actually hurtful to you.
Uh-huh.
You know, your body gets aroused internally and it goes into this, you know, like tense or hyper-arousal state, and then it just kind of gets stuck there. And it keeps happening over and over, and then you end up getting worn down. Versus if you start tracking yourself mindfully, you don't just get stuck there. You can learn how to move through the emotion or find ways to make yourself feel a little calmer or change the inner sensations by some of these practices.
If people would say to you, I am suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, I came out of a very traumatizing kind of experience, whether it be your child experience, your marriage, or otherwise.
Or both, yeah.
How long does it take to get over it? How long does it take to heal
mm-hmm.
from this?
Well, if you're, let's say you're out of the relationship, right?
Yeah.
Let's
mm-hmm.
just say, okay. So let's say you're going to therapy, which I would highly recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also recommend therapies specifically for post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll tell you that, what they are in a minute. But, you know, it really depends. If the trauma is complex, in other words, is also you have developmental trauma from childhood, and now you also have trauma from emotional abuse for this relationship you've been in. You have the loss of the relationship, the loss, you know, so much, you know, and the whole experience of being deceived and betrayed and all that. If you have the childhood stuff with it, it'll take longer. But the first part of it would takes a good year. A good year of, like, if you're staying in therapy, working hard at some practices and therapies. But after that, it can still take years. I think the first year is just the hardest.
So there's no quick fix, and people shouldn't feel bad because healing takes time. And a lot of times people don't understand this. You know, you go through trauma and people will say, well, I don't understand. That was 6 months ago. It's over. You know, why can't you just let go of it? Well, we hear it all the time.
No, it takes years, honestly.
People have no concept.
No.
On how long it takes to heal from something.
The damage is tremendous. And plus, when you leave a relationship and you've had this happen to you where you've been deceived, and, you know, that's traumatic in and of itself. It's humiliating. You feel like a fool. You feel ashamed, you know, all of that stuff. And it's just like mind blowing, you know, when you realize that someone has been deceiving you, and you find that it just is shattering, right? And you feel so like such an idiot and all that. So that's just one phase, kind of like dealing with the shock of that, and then the loss of what you thought you had. You know, that's another phase. You know, and that can take a long time. There's a lot of grief in that, and then you have to rebuild your life from there, right? So that's another big thing to do. Like, who am I now? Who am I? I mean, even if it was a regular divorce, you'd have to think, well, who am I as a single person? You know, how do I go forward? What's my life? You know, there's a lot of uncertainty in that. You have to build. And there could be a lot of other problems, too. If people have financial problems, children, and the fallout on the children that you have to deal with.
Exactly.
So there's a lot. Yeah.
That's what I tell people. There's no quick fix to any of this. And that you need to get the help that you need, that you shouldn't feel funny if you have to go for therapy. And sometimes the therapist can really straighten this out for you.
Yeah.
You know, in good time.
In good time.
But I think it's hard to do it on your own. I think in our cases, we have a lot of support in our system, and it really helps women. But sometimes just support isn't even enough. Yeah, depending on how much the damage has been and how deep the trauma has been.
Yes, and how far it can go. And if there's childhood, the one good thing that can come out of something like this is if you really want to get better, it forces you to deal with the wounds that you never dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
It forces you to go back into your childhood. It does.
And that's hard.
I mean, that can be the good thing in it. Sometimes for people, they develop some kind of spiritual life as a result. And those things can be good. But what you said about support, I don't want to underestimate that. That is crucial in a situation like this, because these kinds of experiences are very isolating. And most people don't understand it. And like the case of the Pakistani woman, you know, people are blaming her for the problem. How traumatic is that, right, on top of it all?
And so many of these women get blamed by the parents. You know, they were such good friends with the in-laws who now blame them for the, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they don't want to look at their son. They just want to look at how she, you know, they thought that she was going to marry him that would cure him. And when it doesn't, they look at her like, why weren't you able to cure him? You know, people are just so ignorant with this subject, but we're trying to make headway and we're trying to get the word out. I'm really excited because we're looking to start a state recognition day for straight wives here in Pennsylvania. I'm working on that now.
Oh,
and I think once
the
word gets out that straight wives need to be recognized for all that they've gone through, and that's not at the expense of anyone else, but just the fact remains that we need to have that kind of recognition. So that's my goal for this year, is to be able to have a straight wife recognition day by next year. So I'm excited. And Marianne, I can't believe our time's really coming to an end. That went so fast.
Yes,
I really want to thank you so much and let you know now that things are, you know, easing up with COVID and things are getting better. I'm hoping you'll come back here sooner than later. Maybe you can come back in the spring and continue this conversation. I really appreciate it. Our women really need it. And thank you so much. I hope things well with you. And to all of our women, thank you for listening and have a wonderful week.
Yes.
Love to all of you.
Take care, everyone.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.